You know the problem? Andy's not here.
I thought I'd greeted by a stunned silence. Well, Brian's put his hand up. Brian.
You know, no, the problem is not Andy. The problem is actually his Paddy. In fact, he just had too much to say. I mean, I'm so many areas
of
topics.
Yeah.
It's very hard to put a finger on it.
Yeah.
I mean, the only one I could put a finger on is Virgin Beginning. And I don't feel like that. It entirely went down the drain. I wanted to put a finger on it. Started out with saying that capitalism had introduced better health for the population, which I believe. We agree with. The only thing is, what he didn't have was a that better health has been introduced at a cost, right? And there's been a lot more pollution now with capitalism than it was in previous societies. For example, you didn't have air conditioners and so forth, and you didn't have the dirty air. In feudalism, because you didn't have the industrialization. With industrialization came the cost, and the cost was pollution. So, yes, I've got better, everybody will agree on that. But unfortunately, we pay the cost with extra pollution, or well, just worse pollution, let's put it that way. So, unfortunately, that's the only thing I could pick up on. But other than that, it was a good talk, Paddy. I mean, you covered a lot of ground. I just hope that ever could contribute us to come up with more answers or questions as well and comments and criticism. Thank you, Paddy.
Okay, thanks, Brian. I think that's right. I think I didn't really say anything about pollution. I barely even mentioned climate change. As I say, scratching the surface there. There's so much to cover, really, isn't there? I think you sort of got the idea that no matter how much I say, there's still so much more. I could have said, I suppose, stuff about pollution. What are we going to do about pollution? I mean, it's just a straightforward clean-up operation at one level. It's new technology, for example, carbon capture and storage. At the moment, is a horizon thing, which may never get off the horizon because it's just so damn expensive, and it's hard to scale up. There have been small-scale CCS gadgets in operation, but they're like, you know, these things are the size of wardrobes, and you need things the size of sort of cities if you're going to have any effect. So and there's talk about geoengineering, cloud seeding with to create global dimming, all these slightly scary ideas that are being put forward. So socialism have to have these sorts of debates. If we get socialism soon, we're going to have these debates about what are we going to do about global warming. Can we reverse it? Do we need to geoengineer? Is it enough simply to stop doing all the bad shit? I think hopefully in most cases it should be enough to stop doing all the bad shit and just let the planet recover. Lots and lots of natural environments will just recover if we stop damaging them. But undoubtedly there's a big problem with pollution, and that would have to be a debate for socialists. Howard's got your hand up. Howard.
You were saying, Paddy, that capitalism has done wonders for global health. And it has, but one of the problems is it's done lots and lots of bad things as well. Overall, it's been positive, the fact that people live so much longer than they did before. They don't die at 30 or 40 or 50 on the whole, etc. But take that news today. I think we've probably all seen it, that this new anti-obesity drug, fantastic invention, which means that fat people you'll be able to be thin or not get fat in the first place. But I mean, it's not being produced because it's something that human beings need. It's being produced in order for farmer to make a fortune and for food manufacturers to be able to continue to produce unhealthy, fattening foods. And it's typical, that, really, of capitalism, isn't it? It's not looking at the overall picture of what's best for humanity. It's looking at what's best for profit. And if by chance it helps some people in some ways, it allows a few obese people to be less obese or thin, fair enough. But it's obvious that the overall effect is going to be a negative rather than a positive one. Can you imagine the resources that have gone into producing this anti-obesity drug, whereas those resources clearly could have been used to produce something far more useful to humanity as a whole than this particular pill that people can take and then sort of go to McDonald's to the heart's content.
Socialism is a giant McDonald's. I think I would slightly push back on that, Howard, when you say things like there are a number of these different fat drugs, aren't there? Ozempic, I think, is one that I can recall, produced by a farmer to make money. Well, of course, everything is done in capitalism to make money. I don't think that necessarily invalidates things that happen in capitalism simply because they're done for money. But I think, and I think people do need something, because the obesity epidemic is now, it's literally it's a pandemic. For instance, what connects Fiji with Greenland? Fiji in the South Pacific, Greenland is, well, near Greenland. It's that the natives of both of those places are almost universally overweight, in fact obese. And there's quite a lot of studies that show that native indigenous populations that have been dispossessed, their land's taken off them, they end up in shit Mac jobs, their old way of life has been destroyed. They turn to, famously in the case of the American Native Americans, they turn to alcoholism, and in Fiji and Greenland they've turned to junk food. They sit at home and just eat junk food and just get hugely fat. And fat is actually a class issue, because it's poor people and dispossessed people and depressed people who tend to eat junk food. Rich people who can afford healthy food tend to eat healthy food, and that is just a fact. So this whole thing about fat and fat drugs is totally a class issue, and it remains to be seen whether these sorts of fat drugs will be made affordable or free on the National Health in the UK to people who actually do need it. But I think there's a lot to say about Ozempic. They work by suppressing the sort of hungry the hungry hormones, like ghrelin is one, and I think I can't remember what the other one's called. Those hormones that tell you that you're hungry, and so these things suppress those so that you just don't eat because you don't feel hungry. But I've talked to people who've got sort of weight problems about this, and what they say is quite interesting. They say all these fat drugs presuppose that people are only overeating because they're hungry all the time. What they don't seem to understand is that people don't always eat because they're hungry. People eat for comfort, even if they're not hungry. And in capitalism, a lot of people are sort of depressed and got mental health problems, and they eat for comfort, and it's a comfort eating thing that is part of this whole process. So these drugs aren't going to do anything for that. So I think it's an interesting subject, and what we would do about that in socialism, I think, change the environment, you change people's mental health status immediately, and change that, and I think you would start to see, and improve the diet, and you would start to see, I think, a decline of this obesity problem. Maybe, but not immediately. It would be a gradual thing, I think. I was just about to say, I appreciate the difficulty with thinking of things to say about this, because we all basically agree on all of this, or pretty much all of it, and I haven't tried to be very controversial or anything, I don't think. I appreciate that it's a bit of a struggle. Mike's got your hand up bravely. Well done, Mike.
You're right there. Cheers. Yeah. Interesting talk and discussion so far. I suppose something that's popped into my mind that's been sort of, alluded to already is that, in capitalism and sort of culture at the moment, we've got that separation between mental health and physical health. Of course, it's already understood that there's, strong links between the two. But I'm guessing that, a socialist society wouldn't have that same separation because, it'd be better understood about, sort of a more sort of holistic view of health. Maybe that's probably the sort of the way to put it. And you get that to some extent in sort of healthcare at the moment. You always have done for in different ways. But I suppose my point is that in a similar way to the feudal times or earlier, they had a sort of a framework of health based on, the humours or, sort of outmoded, structures like that. And obviously, science has helped, sort of refine and shape our sort of understanding of sort of the basis of health. And I guess in socialism as well, by that point, there'd be, a bit of a paradigm shift in our sort of understanding of healthcare. So a lot of the ways we talk about it now will seem, pretty outdated in whatever time in the future, in a similar way to the way that we view, some attitudes about health, from a few hundred years ago. So, I suppose there's a few things that we can't imagine, but I'm guessing that, there'll be a sort of a more holistic view of health rather than that separation of mental and physical health. Yeah, cheers.
Okay, thanks, Mike. I just had the thought there that it seems intuitively likely that socialism would take a sort of more holistic approach to health. I think there's nothing at all wrong with that idea, but it does occur to me that modern science and medical science is as successful as it is, precisely because it's sort of granulated into micro specializations, and each of those specializations is a career for somebody in capitalism anyway, where you can't see the wood for the trees. You can't see the bigger picture. Your ability to be holistic about it is reduced. So I don't really know how socialism would do that. How it manages to be holistic and also granular. But one thing we can be sure of, it's not going to medicalise people for the sake of drug sales. Dougie next, I think. Dougie.
Just trying to unmute. Yeah, that's interesting, Paddy. I mean, Grenfell, that happened or whatever. The people that did the cladding gave 2.5 million donation to the Tories or whatever. And you get that in capitalism, the use dangerous stuff that puts people's lives at risk or whatever. And I was thinking about cars and lorries and things. You could have self-drive cars that are much safer than people driving cars. Well, especially during daylight, anyway. I think they're not so safe in diminished light. I haven't really worked that out. But I mean, there must be millions of, well, a lot of people die in car accidents in the world because human beings are fallible already, you know. But if there were self-drive cars, it might save a lot of lives or whatever, you know. And it begs the question, if we'd all want to have cars in socialism, you know, you better have a better public transport system. And, you know, people wouldn't maybe have to commute so far from work either, really, you know. So, I don't know. I mean, it's just interesting to think about how we do things with technology that can improve safety or whatever, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Dougie. Well, I mean, the strange thing is, if we got socialism tomorrow, we could have self-drive cars immediately, because they work. They don't work perfectly, and this is the problem in capitalism. Who gets sued if there's an accident? That's what they're worried about. They're worried about the litigation penalties. If one of their cars runs over somebody thinking it's a zebra crossing or something, they're worried about the litigation. In socialism, if we could have just a conversation about, okay, there's no question of anyone suing anyone if an electric self-drive car accidentally hits someone, it's just what level of social risk are we prepared to accept as a society? If we're not prepared to accept any risk whatsoever, then it's no self-drive cars. If we're prepared to accept a little bit, then fair enough. But as you say, you know, we would want to be moving away from independent transport anyway and towards public transport. Brian, back to you.
Just to pick up on a little bit on what Mike had to say about the separation between physical and mental health. So, on the surface, it's, you know, from my experience now, I'm speaking as a benefits advisor, and I've filled in, I would guess, thousands of disability forms for different people in the South Wales area and back there in London as well. I remember going up to London and filling a form for Eddie Grant. Yeah, his health deteriorated, and I was working up at that office at the time, and I offered to fill in his disability form, which I did, but he never claimed it. You know, proud, silly man, in my opinion. But anyway, I digress. In my experience with disability, there is always a connection between the physical health and the mental health. The first thing that we would dream of within disability is the physical health. Because that if, knowing what the physical health was, it would then have some idea what the mental health was going to be. For instance, somebody with chronic rheumatoid arthritis is going to be really, really frustrated because their independence is just about gone and it's going to get worse and worse. Right. And with that frustration, there's anger, rage, anxiety, and depression, obviously, and that all goes together. But further on that, with that as well, in regards to separation between the health, right? Well, the other thing that capitalism gives us is, on appearances, there is a holistic approach. I mean, for example, we call it the National Health Service. When you scratch the surface, you find it's not exactly a national health service. Yes, it does provide health services, does provide medication, does provide surgical help, etc., etc. Right? But it's not a holistic approach, it's all it does. It's medication, hospital care, etc. And then when you're well, they try and get rid of you as fast as possible, fill up the bed and stuff, it's at the access of the urgent need of further repair, right? But where they are able to put you depends on what resources are available. And that's where the service breaks down, and that's where it's not a national health service. Nothing like a national health service, because the aftercare is virtually non-existent and depends to a great deal on which area you live in and how much money you got. If you've got the money, you can afford aftercare after you've had your medical and before you discharge from hospital. But other than that, you know, you're on your bloody own. You just got to look after yourself and expect the best. Don't be taking it. There is definitely within capitalism of this separation. And we choose to go the world between them, like I said, calling the national health service, but in actual fact, it's not a national health service. Never will be that likely to be. Will be. You know, the only thing, in my opinion, which is, you know what I'm going to say here, the only thing, in my opinion, is going to bring about a health service, natural or whatever, is socialism. You know, where you'll be joining up all the dots. You will have the aftercare to go through a visa holistic system. That's all I've got to say. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Brian. I'm glad you mentioned the NHS, because that's an area of health that I, on reflection, just seems like a major omission. I didn't mention the NHS or how a socialist health service would work. It would, in some ways, be a bit like the NHS. Just a couple of things on that. There was a story recently about I think it was an Alzheimer's drug that the NICE, the was it National Institute for Clinical Care and Clinical Excellence or something like that, said that the NHS wasn't going to provide because it was too expensive, and there was a bit of an outcry, which I thought was a bit of a strange kind of reaction from people who I guess are so used to being free on the NHS that they think that they should be entitled to absolutely any drug, no matter how marginally effective it might be. And I was a bit surprised at that reaction. NICE has to make decisions like that. It has to decide. That's what it's for. It has to decide, well, is there any, what's the real benefit of this drug versus how much is it going to be? Is it worth it? Should we do it? And I'm amazed that in the NHS in America, it's denigrated as death committees by the right wing, which I find astonishing, when Americans are perfectly free not to be able to afford any treatment at all. That's their notion of freedom, is to not get any treatment because they can't afford it. Whereas over here, you've got a committee like NICE deciding. So I just find that just unbelievable. But you also mentioned disability, and I was thinking, I remember being in London on the tube and seeing a sign that said no disabled access to this from this station, and I thought, if you're somebody, a wheelchair user, and you get in and this is the station you want to go to, and you see that, what are you supposed to do? The lifts were out of order, I think. And in days of yore, this sort of thing would be normal. How people got around if they were in wheelchair, God only knows, it would be impossible. And this applies to mental health as well, because there's the, you know, Brian, you'll know all about this, the medical model of disability, which is, you know, you're disabled because your legs don't work. And versus the social model of disability, which is you can't get up, you can't get around in your wheelchair because we haven't provided any ramps. It's society that's disabling you, not your medical condition. And the same applies to mental health in a lot of cases. It's society that makes people mentally ill, not some internal condition, although there may be some genetic factor at work as well. So I just thought I'd mention those things. I sort of did cover that in the talk a little bit by just saying, you know, it's capitalism and it has these stresses that make people, yeah, just ill, physically and mentally ill. Okay, so Janet Carter, I think you're next, aren't you?
Yeah, thank you, Paddy. That was a really interesting talk and has made me want to go off in 101 directions, so I try to limit myself to a straight line. I think the recent mention that you and Brian have made about the NHS and how it has to restrict the supply of a drug because it's said to be costing, it would cost one for one person £30,000 a year or something like awful like that, and of course it would not be that within socialism, so that would make a free supply of really necessary drugs. But there's an awful lot of stuff that's supplied unfortunately within the NHS that again wouldn't be necessary because people wouldn't get these conditions. And I think this present obesity thing is something like that, because people have become de-skilled, and de-skilled in cooking as well, ridiculously, as it seems, because of the amount of programs that there are on television, but not everybody watches those, and anyway they're rather overwhelming. When I was young, many, many, many decades ago, people used to live very simply. We didn't have any choice. And so there was the thing about one-pot meals, that you put everything nutritious in a pot and cooked it up. And as I remember, it tasted delicious and still does. So that's a sort of a nutritious meal that could be put together by people who are fairly de-skilled in cooking but could manage something like that. But that's not done now, because what has been done is the pushing of cheap food like beef burgers, and followed by a fizzy drink and French fries, and it's the worst possible diet for people that actually can't afford or don't know any better. And again, many of us don't know any better because, like I just said, we've been de-skilled in the art of cheap cooking. Perhaps our present chef, travelling chef, can talk about that. That would be interesting. And again, I go back to this obesity crisis. It is a crisis, but it's quite horrifyingly, in a way, self-inflicted, but inflicted by the society that we live in, because we learn in the society that we live in, and we're learning to be de-skilled as well in certain aspects of life. People would do an awful amount of growing for themselves, but now, again, people might have a small patch of ground in which they could grow something, but perhaps don't know how to. It's an awful shame that we're losing a lot of things that we did know, because again, things are being pushed towards us to make life, in a way, easier for what considered to be easier, but in fact, it's less interesting in a way. And I think your strong idea about community kitchens is something that might come in useful here. If we go over to socialism before many of us relearn the skills of cooking cheaply or efficiently, we could go to a communal kitchen, which would be nice because we'd have company as well while we were eating more nutritious food, and that would be really, really good. I think I'm going to stop there because I've started rambling. Thank you. Thank you again, Paddy. That was fascinating, your talk.
Thanks, Janet. Yeah, well, that was, yeah, a lot of what you said there was interesting, about the de-skilling of people. I remember, I can't remember where I read this, somebody here might know, it might have been in something by George Woodcock when he was talking about early industrial Britain. He was certainly talking about how the pocket watch came about as that bit of technology, as a result of people needing to know the time all of a sudden, because they had to get to work, you know, and this is why clocks were put on church steeples, so that people could see the time, so that they could sort of clock in for their shift at the factory. prior to that, you know, through hundreds and hundreds of years, people didn't only, you know, could just use the sun. That was as accurate as they needed to be. But one of the things about moving from cottage industries into factories was that people couldn't cook. They couldn't cook at home, and so canteen food became a thing in the industrial age of Britain. Prior to which, Britain had actually had something of an international reputation as for fine cuisine, apparently, only among the rich, obviously. The rest of us, I'm sure, just ate porridge or something. But, fine cuisine. And because of the British Empire, you know, because the British fingers were in every single pie all the way around the world. So, but then the industrial age meant people couldn't cook. They lost all the cooking skills. This was back in the 1800s, you know. And this is why preservatives started being put in foods, just because to stop them spoiling, because they were in canteen pots for literally days on end. This kind of thing. But I think in socialism, a lot of these sort of problems about being de-skilled would go away after one generation, because the first thing we would be doing, I think, is training the kids, because they wouldn't just be learning, you know, all the sorts of communal social skills. They would be doing bits of work, because kids like to do work. They like to help. They like to help the adults. And what better way than to teach them useful things that they will know they will be able to put to use throughout their lives? There was lots more that you said, Janet, that I could get into, but Richard's got his hand up, so over to Richard.
Okay, hi. I was really interested in what Janet was saying, because I have kind of multiple food problems. I've cooked for myself all my life, and I cook from scratch. I cook everything from scratch every night. I don't use processed food or very, very little processed food, and I have to check everything before I eat it. And the problem that I think people have with cooking good food is that it's time consuming. Now, I cook largely one pot meals. I make my meals very simple and I cook from scratch. But in order to cook well, it takes me about an hour to an hour, 15 minutes every night cooking. Yeah? And I think the problem with capitalism is that people, especially now that, you know, sort of both partners, husband and wife, will probably be out of work and during the day, and they come home, and the time, I'm sure there is a loss of skills. I'm absolutely sure that Janet is right about that, but I think one of the big issues is the actual time that it takes. That actually, you know, you're tired, you come home, and so it's much more convenient to just go out and buy a packet meal and stick it in the oven and sort of survive on that. So I think that's also a big factor in capitalism. That's all I wanted to say on that. But the other thing, Paddy, I'm sorry, I'm really sleepy right at the moment. I didn't get any sleep last night. And I thought your talk was absolutely fascinating, but I only took a fraction in. I hope this is recorded and that we're going to see it, because there seems to be such a lot of useful information there, which, like, I was just not able to take in. So, as I say, I hope you've recorded it. Cheers.
Okay, thanks, Richard. I attempted to record it, although my sound thing is a bit on the blink at the moment, but hopefully I did. With typical opportunism, Adams also asked me if I could convert some of this into some articles for the Standard, so some of it may get sort of regurgitated in some form. And also there is the fact that some of us are doing, we're rewriting the Socialism's Practical Alternative pamphlet, sort of because, as I think I mentioned last time, you know, it was done about 30 years ago. It's about time we sort of revisited it. So, you know, some of this could end up in there as well. I was going to say about the cooking takes an hour as well, Richard. You mentioned that cooking takes about an hour. Yeah, okay. But I've always done it myself, and I don't regard it as a loss, a waste of time. I think to do something like that, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it well, and you might as well enjoy it. And if you enjoy it, it's not a waste of time. It's just a sort of part of your day that is, you know, reasonably pleasurable. Anyway, moving on.
Well, can I just come briefly back on?
Oh yeah, go on then.
I actually enjoy cooking.
Ah, yeah.
I actually enjoy doing it, but that's because that I have time on my hands in the evenings, you know. And lots of people who may sort of even be moonlighting, or if, you know, sort of families who are cooking for kids and partners. You know, in the old days where one partner, usually the wife, stayed at home and could actually spend time doing something like that, that's not available to many families at all, because both partners are out at work and they both come home pretty tired.
Yeah.
You know, so just as a comment on that.
No, of course you're absolutely right. Okay, now moving on, Howard, you've got your hand up. Howard.
Just a quick one, Paddy. How does another item from today's news fit into some of the things you've said, in particular about the way production is organised and indeed about the environment? The item I'm talking about is the shelving of this banned coal mine in Cumbria.
Mm.
Some people are saying that this would have provided jobs for locals, but the opposition says no, it would ruin the environment. In this case, capitalism seems to come down on the side of the environment. But on the other hand, you know, there are people who say no, we'll lose out by it. What's your take on that? How does that fit into some of the points you've been making?
Well, the background on this particular coal mine is it was a particular sort of coke that burns at an incredibly high temperature, which they use in steel production. And most of this coke from this Whitehaven mine would have been actually shipped to Europe for European steel making, so it wouldn't have been used locally. But regardless, since a previous judgment on another site down south, set a precedent whereby you can't just consider the cost of setting up the mine, you've also got to consider the lifetime environmental costs of all the coal or coke that's produced in that and the carbon cost. And so this time the new Labour government took over the case from the previous Tory government that had given the go-ahead, and that had been challenged by Friends of the Earth, I think, and Greenpeace. And the Labour government just said, well, the legal precedent has now been set. This makes this mine non-starter. We're walking away from this case, and left the mine company basically holding the bag. And they promptly lost the case in the High Court. They probably aren't. That's probably the end of it. This idea about it would have created local jobs. Well, supposing you brought back capital punishment and started executing prisoners, that would give a job. That would create a few jobs, wouldn't it, for executioners? But are we going to do it just because of that reason? I think that. This argument about something creates jobs is just a bit of a bogus argument, you know. So what if it creates jobs? If it's environmentally destructive, we don't want it. So what's my position on that in socialism? This is going back to the energy question, isn't it? I mean, in the particular case of steel production, the hope is that we would be able to go over to green hydrogen, which is a form of energy that could be used in steel making. At the moment, there's very, very little green hydrogen available. That's to say environmental hydrogen, because most of the hydrogen is extracted from fossil fuels in the mining process or the drilling process. Very little of it. Very little of it is natural, because even if you catalyse hydrogen out of seawater, you still got to use electricity. How have you got the electricity? Usually from fossil fuels. but increasingly from solar or renewables. So anyway, yeah, there's a whole kind of story behind that. I was quite pleased to see that coal mine had not been approved, but not particularly surprised. I would have been pretty surprised if the new Labour government had gone along with the Tories and, you know, Donald Trump, who I just saw described memorably today as a walking oil slick. I thought that was rather good. So I would have been surprised if the Labour government had gone along with that mining application. I don't know if that answers your question, Howard.
Yeah, it's fine, Paddy. Yeah, just wanted to sort of give you the chance to mention it, since it's in the news today. And it did relate to some of the points you were making about the way production and the criteria according to which production will take place in socialism.
Yeah, I mean everything depends, doesn't it, on when we would be likely to get socialism. I mean, it's not looking very likely at the moment, so this is all very much castles in the air territory. And I know this is why some people say, well, we shouldn't be talking about the future at this point. But, you know, people ask us these sort of things. What would you do about this? What would you do about that? You know, I remember somebody saying, would there be any pubs in socialism? It's funny how people's minds work. It's like, well, I bloody hope so. I wouldn't be very happy if there were no pubs. But then they were like, yeah, well, how would the pubs get supplied? Who would supply it? Where do you get the drivers from? Who makes the beer? Where does the beer get made? This sort of thing. So people have their own way of sort of processing how socialism might work. Even if it's only about beer, they've still got to ask the same kinds of questions. And they ask, and they will ask us. And, you know...
Yeah, I mean, that's largely what this... You know, this moneyless society group, their Facebook page. That's largely what the posts are about. You know, how would you do this and how would you do that without money, and so on and so forth. It's largely about that.
Yeah.
People do ask these questions. Yeah. Mm. And you know, it's worth engaging with them as well, if you can. Even if it's just to say, well, we don't know, but possibly it might be like this. Possibly it might be like that.
Paula's got your hand up.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Right, so I've enjoyed the talk this evening, actually.
Good.
Because I do really think we should dwell on more on, you know, how things would be better under socialism. You know, instead of always just sort of saying how bad capitalism is. And Two things resonated with me personally tonight. It's just because it's two of my things. And the first thing was your mention of canals, because I do think it's such a shame that the Tories built this massive canal network, and then it was almost immediately became defunct because of the railway system. And I would love to see canals introduced as a means of transport. And the other thing was what Janet was talking about, you know, cooking and kitchens. And I'm really looking forward to the day when we have, like, soup kitchens, you know, proper soup kitchens where, you know, people on the street just, I don't know, I've got a really good chicken soup recipe. You know, that I could cook for 20 people. You know that kind of that communal activity. You know, where we're not all just atomised individuals in our own little houses. You know, cooking our, well, not even cooking, but just getting takeaways. You know, how much nicer would it be just to, you know, go to the local? I know it could be stew, couldn't it? You know, it doesn't have to be soup. You know, to get a local, you know, a nourishing meal that's cheap to quickly, that's cooked cheap. Sorry, I'm getting all muddled. Yeah, that's cooked cheaply and nutritionally. So you know, thanks, comrades. I've enjoyed the discussion tonight. Cheers.
Thanks, Paula. Yeah, I think I agree. I think it is useful. I think also people out there, you know, would probably respond to a positive image of socialism. I know people have said this loads of times. Loads of party members have said this, and you know, just going on about the evils of capitalism is sort of kind of telling people what they already know. I'm glad you like canals, Paula. I live right next to a canal. It's very beautiful a lot of the time, except people keep throwing rubbish shopping trolleys into it at my end of the canal, because I live at the cheap end of town. My thing is tall ships, so I would love to see lots of tall ships, but it's not very efficient from a transport point of view. You mentioned soup kitchens, and you've got a chicken soup recipe. I'm afraid that'll be no good for vegans and vegetarians, but of course we won't be there, will we? We'll all be off getting psychiatric therapy, according to that economist that I mentioned earlier. Any other comments? 9:10, so we've made a good effort tonight. As I say, I think it's well done for finding things to say when basically we already agree. No, nobody's got anything to say. Shall we call it a day? I think we'll call it a day, shall we? So thanks everybody for coming. Next week it'll be Andy. Andy will be back from holiday. He's usually exuberant self, and giving us a talk on a subject of... Ooh, that's some noisy... That was somebody being very noisy there. All right, then. So, yeah.
Okay, see you next week.
All right. See you all next week, then.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Night.
Bye.
Thank
you. Bye.
Thanks very much. Cheerio.
Everybody take care.